Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research, and we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show. And it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Real deal for a take two, because it's the 104th anniversary of the sinking of the RMS Titanic, where RMS stands for Royal Mail Ship. These were those that were transporting the Royal Mail from the British Empire around the world. Gary King thought that it might be appropriate to do a show about the Titanic, even though most people believe it was simply a tragic accident and that there was nothing conspiratorial about it. As we're going to discover this evening, that does not appear to be the case, that actually there were developments in the background of which the public was completely unaware. That entered into the events that led to the sinking of the Titanic when it collided with an iceberg during its maiden voyage from Southampton, United Kingdom, to New York. The ship was the largest and most luxurious afloat at the time. It had a length of 883 feet. Construction began on March 31st, 1908. And it was launched on May 31st, 1911, 2 years in construction. Its weight or displacement, 52,310 pounds. Its designer, Thomas Andrews, was aboard the ship and was also lost with more than 1,500 other passengers. James Cameron, of course, produced a film, Titanic, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet, which is one of my top 10 films of all time, in 1997. So I'm a huge fan of the Titanic, the film, and of the mystery of Titanic, the shipwreck, and very pleased to bring on with me this evening, Gary King. Gary, welcome to The Real Deal.
Man, honored to be here as usual, Dr. Fetzer. When I suggested that we do a Titanic show, I wasn't aware that there was a conspiracy about it. Though I've researched the Titanic for many, many, many years, and I would say with equal intensity as JFK. So this is all new to me. So the last 2 days, I've immersed myself into the conspiracy, and in fact, the video that we're going to play. And the second hour is what we're going to be discussing. So, like I said, I wasn't aware that there was any type of conspiracy. So you've always told me that you're a professor of 35 years of philosophy and using scientific evidence to reach conclusions. Well, we're going to have to put it to work tonight, Dr. Fetzer. So,
That's very good, Gary, because, of course, it's a fundamental principle of scientific reasoning that conclusions must be based upon all of the available relevant evidence. Evidence consists of any physical or testimonial statements or findings that could make a difference to an issue. It's relevant when its truth or falsity, presence or absence matters. And of course, it's available only when we have access to it. And what we're talking about here are new discoveries related to the Titanic to which you, for example, have not had access in the past, but where I was lucky enough to stumble over this very fine documentary some years ago. And therefore, when you proposed our doing a show, I was eager to recommend it to you. I'm so glad to have you here And we can begin with your first slide, Gary, which actually looks like it's water.
The first card? Well, no, well, that's the title page, but the white star, the one that's been up. Yeah, there we go.
All right, let's stay there.
Yeah, that's more or less like your title page there. So what we're going to do is progress forward and take a look at the things that are brought to the table, and we'll use scientific analysis. And there's no way that we could really figure everything out within, you know, just a couple of days. So we're going to march forward from there. So the next slide we have.
Well, yeah, let's talk about this one in a moment. Go back to the other. I notice it says here 45,000 tons each, but the weight that I give or displacement was 52,310. So I'm wondering whether that difference of 7,310 tons is supposed to be from equipment that was brought aboard the ship, the passengers, their luggage, and so forth. Would you have an opinion about that, Gary?
Well, it's common knowledge that they purposely made the Titanic a little bit heavier and just a little wee bit bigger just so they could boast that it was the largest ship afloat at the time, even though the Atlantic, in other words, you always have to go for the next biggest thing, right? And
even though the Olympic, which preceded it, was at its time, when it was launched, the largest and most luxurious.
Absolutely. They were sister ships built in the same berth. We have a picture of that. And if you look on the next picture right there, you'll see them in the background. You'll see the berth. There's, I think the Titanic is in that one, and the Olympic has already been launched. You can see one of the berths in the background. So that's the Howland & Wolf crew. There were 16,000 men strong. They worked very, very hard. They were given 7 minutes a day to use the restroom. If you didn't make it in on time, they closed the gate on you, and that was just tough luck. So it was hard times. And
seven minutes a day.
Everybody had a card. It was a wooden card, and you would go in, and they had a man, and that was his job, is to make sure that you didn't go in the bathroom for more than 7 minutes a day.
Now, what if you were in the middle of something serious?
Well, then you're going to have to go home, because after 7 minutes, you're out of here. You're wasting our time.
Really?
They had everything down to the dollar, and they had many, many people working very hard here. And these people were very happy to have their jobs. There were many people that did not have it. And in fact, this was Belfast's industry. Everything else was built around the Howland & Wolf shipyard. So if you go ahead and go to the next one. Now, part of the conspiracy that we're confronting tonight is that J.P. Morgan, who was co-owner of the White Star Line, or the Mercantile Marine, and if you can, so he canceled at the last moment his voyage, saying that he was ill. So part of the conspiratorial side is that he knew what was going to happen and he canceled out. But however, if we go to the
don't rush. Sounds like Larry Silverstein, who had breakfast every day he had owned the World Trade Center until 9/11, when he claimed that his wife had made for him a dermatological appointment and therefore he missed, as did his daughter, where the two of them both had their offices in the North Tower. But that day, isn't it interesting? He wasn't there, Gary. And here you're saying the owner of the ship line, which ordinarily would have been expected to be aborted, fell ill. Isn't that fortuitous?
Well, he wasn't as much as part of the White Star Line as Bruce Ismay. See, he was like the financier when White Star was having financial problems. He basically came in and bought up the company with his shares. But they still were a subsidiary of J.P. Morgan as a whole. He was doing much more than just shipping. So the next picture we have is actually Bruce Ismay and Lord Perry. He's the head of the Harlan & Wolf shipyard, and that's actually Bruce Ismay. Now,
who, of course, is the taller man with the cane.
Right. As Bruce Ismay, now there's something to be in consideration here. He was on board, as was Thomas Andrews, the designer of the ship. Now, so we've got to take that into consideration, that that this is some heavy, heavy accusations that they planned on allowing thousands of people to go to the watery grave.
No, Gary, that's not actually the theory.
No?
They were supposed to have been saved, but something went amiss with regard to the rescue, and that's why so many drowned. It was not that was the plan.
What I would be thinking in that particular situation is that they were counting on the Californian, which we do have a picture of down there, to save them. Many things can go wrong. That was a small ship with only one steam engine. Many things could go wrong. So the having at least enough lifeboats to save everyone, because the liability was enormous. They had to pay for the school for all of these children, and all of the women were taken care of off to school.
Slow down and back up, Gary. You're getting ahead of yourself. What you were saying is that after the ship had gone down and so many lives had been lost, which I'm reasonably certain was not actually the plan, which was rather for the ship to go down, but all the souls aboard to be saved. You're saying that White Star Line, as it were magnanimously, or so it would appear to the public, provided education and other forms of support to the families of those who had lost relatives, especially parents aboard the ship on the disaster.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Dr. Fetzer. You know, if you're going to sink the ship and you know it, then you make sure there's enough lifeboats, because that was one of their biggest liabilities, that they didn't have enough lifeboats. So if you're going to sink it, then make sure there's enough lifeboats. There's already enough that can go wrong at sea in the middle of the night when you're planning on sinking a vessel. So I just think that we have to weigh the evidence that it is a huge, huge gamble. And on top of that, Bruce Ismay, life was ruined. He went into, not exile, but he moved off to someplace in Ireland and was rarely ever heard from again. So his life was ruined.
Well, I mean, the public regarded this as a complete disgrace, that the ship had sunk. Even if it had been accidental, it wasn't the sort of thing that was supposed to happen. It had to have shaken confidence in the White Star Line, all of its owners, everyone who had anything to do with the ship, its construction, and the particular crews that led to this disaster. So I think, that could have been the effect, Gary, regardless whether Ismay was himself aware of the plan that the ship should be taken down. So, of course, we haven't got around to begin to talk about the rationale behind it, why anyone would plan to sink the world's largest and most luxurious cruise ship. We'll get to that, Gary.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so let's take a look at Captain Smith before we go into the reason that they might want to sink the ship. All right, so here's Captain Smith, his final voyage, and ready for retirement. He was going to retire after this voyage, and it was all over for White Star Line. And that's one heck of a way to go out, as they said in the movie. How about let's go out with a bang, AEJ?
Well, Gary. I mean, it was going to be his last cruise, which would have been a fitting way by taking the world's most largest and most luxurious ship on its maiden voyage. Do you think that the captain was himself, I guess there's a reason to believe that he may have been.
Well, in the documentary, they're saying that, look, we've taken care of you well. Ismay speaking to him. If you've always lived well, you've stayed in the finest hotels, drank the best brandy, and it's time for you to pay us back. So the documentary is suggesting that he was basically arm twisted into doing this. So
continue.
Okay, now the next picture is what started it all. Now, What has happened is that there was a minor collision with a tugboat before this collision here. Okay, so if I'm not mistaken, I think it threw a propeller blade. So if you look at the propellers, which we'll see later on, you'll see that there's three blades bolted on. And so if I'm not mistaken, the collision with the tugboat resulted in a blade being needed to be removed, or it's possible that it just threw a blade. But it did have a collision. And
yeah,
part of
this was not a major issue, although from the look of that, obviously, there's in fact, this is after this is not from the collision with the tugboat, Gary.
This is the Hawk. This is
you got to make that clear.
I was trying to do that. I was saying that it hit a tugboat first. There was
There were two different collisions involving, and now we're not talking about Titanic. We are talking about Olympic.
That's right. And so part of the documentary is saying that that Captain Smith wasn't really such a great captain, and he had gotten in many wrecks before, so he wasn't the clean guy who couldn't be blackmailed in such a way. So the point that they're trying to make is that part of the damage, which they're saying that the Olympic was damaged beyond repair, and they felt it was necessary to sink the whole ship as opposed to repairing it. So we're talking about two collisions.
Well, I think we're talking about damage that would be like bending the frame on an automobile.
Right.
Cannot be repaired, and that they devised an insurance scam where they would substitute the Olympic for the Titanic, that the ship would go down so they could get coverage for the ship that had been damaged in these two prior incidents, the first of which with a tugboat was less significant, relatively minor, but the second with the HMS Hawk was serious and had the equivalent effect of, say, twisting the hull ever so slightly, but as to make it not any longer reliably seaworthy.
Right. Looking at the damage, in fact, if we go down a couple of, we have a picture of the Olympic moving out. Yeah, that's them repairing the shaft of the Olympic. That's when they took. See, if you go to the next picture, we can go back.
That's from the tugboat damage, is it not?
Right. This is a propeller from the Titanic being fitted on the Olympic. It either threw a propeller blade or the tugboat caused the propeller blade, but that's a separate.
The tugboat damaged the propeller blade.
Right.
So they cannibalized a blade from Titanic.
Right. And that's the blade.
Olympic to be a fix, you know, more like a Band-Aid.
That's right. Now this blade has a number stamped on it. 401. The Olympic parts that were going to the Olympic were stamped 400. So later on, when we're looking at the bottom of the ocean, you're supposed to be able to see the 401 blade. So that would be some evidence on the against the conspiracy. So we're just weighing evidence right now.
Well, but if they put the blade on the Olympic, Gary, and if it was 401, if it was the Olympic at the bottom of the sea, it would have 401 on the blade.
Yeah, it would have to be that particular blade, too, because they all would say 401. So we'll just have to look into it more. I have movies and stuff.
Well, the blade, are you talking about just one of the three extensions of the prop?
Right. We're not talking about the whole propeller. No, not at all.
Not the whole propeller?
No, just one of the blades. It's actually bolted on. It's bolted.
Okay.
So there you see. All right. So I'm pretty sure that particular one is when they had to fit the entire propeller from the Titanic.
This, of course, would simply generate what would seem to be confirming evidence, since the public was unaware that they had made this substitution of a blade. When you discover that blade at the bottom of the sea, it would look as though that was confirmation it was, in fact, Titanic.
That's what I'm saying. If the blades are saying 401, and especially more than one, that would be it. But you see, this is when the entire propeller was changed. The collision from the tugboat was resulted in just one blade being changed, not the entire propeller.
Yeah, keep going, Gary. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we can go back to the shaft being repaired.
Go back two slides, Chance.
Yeah, right there. Okay, I have to say it doesn't look like a bent shaft to me. From what I understand, there's different estimates on the repair. Now, the estimates was $123,000. Now, I'll just say that on the upper deck in the first class cabins, some of those promenade decks cabins went for $50,000 in money back in 1912. We're not talking about today's dollars. So it was enormously expensive. So I guess, can we go down a little bit further until I can see the right picture?
Sure. Chance can move us forward on the image.
Wait there a second. Yeah, keep going. All right, go ahead and go back. I see what's going on. All right. What we're saying, there's a famous picture of the Olympic. It's a movie. And we've all seen it leaving port, and everyone is waving. And see, many of these pictures are from the Olympic, and it's very easy to get them confused. All right. So,
well, they were sister ships, but they did have some distinguishing features. Are you familiar with the features that were different?
Yeah, I guess we can get into that right now. Right here, the slide that's showing right now is showing, I think this is the one with 16. If we're on slide 13, that's the one, that's the Olympic with 16 portholes. From here to here, you can count them yourself. All right, now the next picture, 14. Then there's only 14 now.
Yes, and that's right. Titanic.
Right, this is the Titanic. Now, the next slide coming is the Titanic with 16 portholes now.
Which means, of course, that it's Olympic.
That's a possibility. Yes, it is. There's a possibility that they drilled a couple more portholes. You know, we're only weighing it out.
Are they spaced the same way?
Let's go back and look. There's like a group of five of them. There's two of them together. There's one in the middle, and there's those two. There's the first porthole.
And that's from Olympic.
Right. The first one is the Olympic.
So what that shows is that the Titanic with the Olympic configuration is actually the Olympic renamed as the Titanic. There. That's supposed to be Titanic, right? But it's actually Olympic.
Yeah, the next one you can read Titanic. If you look underneath the third porthole, is the first letter T.
I think you can read it. Which of course means they renamed it in terms of what they painted or configured on. Yeah, this looks like Titanic right there, Gary.
Right.
The third portal, you can see the T-I-T-A-N-T.
Right. Sure is.
That's the portal configuration for the Olympic.
If you look at
the first picture is that one.
Gary, Chance.
If you look at the pattern, they both end at the farthest with a single, a double, a single, a double, and then they go all singles. And it's
right.
Both of them are the same. In this picture, and in this one.
Right, which are the, and of course this one we know is Olympic, which right. means that the second one, which has the same configuration, is also Olympic, and that in the middle is the Titanic, which does not have that. Go to that one again. Yeah, that's very good. I think that's maybe that's one of the few distinguishing features that's most conspicuous. Very good.
Yes. All right, so we can go to. If you want to go down, there's the window controversy. All right, so stop that one right there, right there. Okay, so part of the conspiracy is that those windows.
No, you don't mean part of the conspiracy. You say part of the proof that there may have been a substitution of the ships is the windows.
Well, I'm trying to look at both sides. All right, looking at these windows.
Well, Gary, you're not already convinced by the what we've already seen.
No, not at all.
You aren't?
No.
That's fascinating. Okay, go ahead.
There's a lot of possibilities, and there's a lot of things to consider here, and I'm more than willing to consider them. You know, like I said, I want to look at it in a philosophy way that Dr. Fetzer would look at anything you've ever taken on.
You mean in a scientific fashion. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. After Paul McCartney, nothing's too out there for me, Dr. Fetzer.
You know, did that blow your mind, Gary?
Just blew my head through the door. I mean, my goodness. I used to play my friend and I, we played John Lennon, Paul McCartney. I was John, he was Paul. They were part of my life. You know the whole thing. But just to know that it's not just that. There's just so many things. But
you know, Gary, I actually think that Paul's replacement was actually a more talented musician than Paul.
He was a keyboard player like no other. He was highly skilled on the piano. Now, let me make a quick example if we can go off track
a
little
bit. Yeah, we're fine. We're talking about replacing one with another where they look a lot alike, but they aren't the same.
And in this
case of Paul McCartney, I mean, I understand why you found it so shocking to have the evidence adduced, but continue. Yeah, tell me more about it.
Well, let's take a look at just the piano playing alone. All right, as far as I know, Paul McCartney did not play piano as a main instrument whatsoever. He kind of did like most musicians, kind of can tinker around and play chords left and right. Now think about this. How many songs do we have that John Lennon played piano? All right, well, Imagine is one of them. Now, I'm telling you, I teach piano to students. That's one of the first songs that you learn in the first week or two. You can learn
that. That suggests it must be very elementary from the point of view of the keyboard.
So is all of them, like Instant Karma, that's just hitting chords, like in quarter note fashion. You see? Now, compare that to Lady Madonna.
Yeah. Very complicated.
That's playing piano.
Hey, Madonna.
That's right. And trust me,
I love it.
It takes years to develop that kind of hand separation to where you can play like that. So look, we're talking about the greatest band to ever set foot on the earth, and they were the hottest band. So they're not going to bring in some schmuck who can't play. You know, they brought in a badass, and he is fantastic, and he can play piano like nobody else, but he's a little slow.
It's taken me a long time, Gary, to realize that actually I believe that Paul's replacement was a superior musician, and he may have had more musical creativity than Paul. I mean, that's almost apocryphal for those of us who love the Beatles, but I love the Beatles. I've done a Beatles tribute show. When I had the real deal as a pure radio show, every single program, every buffer, every break was nothing but Beatles from beginning to end for 880 shows, Gary.
Dr. Fetzer, I got to tell on you. On our way to Dallas to the conference, you were singing the entire White Album out loud at the top of your lungs the whole way going. So Dr. Fetzer's a Beatles like nobody. Can you imagine Dr. Fetzer back in the USSR? And that was him. So we had a good time. But so once again, just looking at the music, at the piano playing, look at John whenever he's playing piano, and then look at at Paul McCartney. He's just wailing all over the place. So that's just one of many, many things.
And you mean, when you say Paul now, you mean Fall, F-A-U-L, his replacement, or False Paul?
Very comfortable on piano, very clumsy on bass. And you see, I'm also a bass player, and I teach bass. I teach bass guitar for a living. I mean, that's what I do. All right, so I have the entire Beatles book, and if you go up to 1966, I have to give it to Paul McCartney. Those are some of the most incredible bass lines. You can put them up against anyone. But then after 1966, the bass lines completely change. They're more of a stumbling more around. It's just not like just listen to the bass line on Twist and Shout. It goes do 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 do. That's a lot of bass line going on. And it's also one's in ascending, the guitar's ascending, the bass line's descending. So Paul McCartney is one of the greatest bass players that has ever walked the planet, but he was not a killer piano player, and it's vice versa. Fall was a fantastic piano player and a very, very ordinary bass player.
Gary, these are wonderful observations. And of course, you know, I myself was unconvinced we really were dealing with two different individuals until I encountered the study by the two Italian forensic scientists who set out to disprove the hypothesis that Paul had died and been replaced, and discovered to their astonishment that it was true because they had different teeth. Paul had bad teeth and a small palate. Fall had good teeth and a large palate, different ears, different size and shape of the skull. Fall had a slightly longer face, a slightly larger head. Paul had a rounder face. And, of course, a difference in height, where we have Paul with Jane Asher, to whom he was engaged. And then we have Fall with Jane Asher. Paul and Jane are very near the same height, but Fall towers over Jane. He's at least 4 inches taller.
Right. Well, that's what I'm doing here, Dr. Fetzer. I'm doing exactly what those Italian scientists are doing. I'm trying to disprove this theory. Now, you know what? It might end up exactly what happened to them. They found out that it really did happen, and Paul was replaced. Now, that's why I'm here, and that's what I'm trying to do. Now, I'm going to try to disprove it.
Well, you're giving additional proof that he was replaced, you know. I mean, you got the Sgt. Pepper album, after all, which is a funeral, and you've got a grave, and you got a left-handed bass guitar there. Then you got the Beatles all in black at the side, and then you got the resplendent Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band introducing the one and only Billy Shears, and now Paul is taller than before. And from this point on, they start wearing a lot of beards and mustaches and other stuff to conceal that this is, in fact, a different person who's known as Paul McCartney.
Exactly. So let me think. All right, now, think about it like this. Up until after 1966, you will never see John Lennon and Paul McCartney singing to the same microphone ever again. And the black and white Beatles that we're used to, those are gone for good. Then it turns into the colored Beatles. You see? And now think about
in terms of the cover, in terms of the Sgt. Pepper cover.
Right. Now think about this. You're pretty much selling out every venue. You're going around the world. People are screaming. You're the hottest thing that has ever been. You're the greatest band that will ever come along. And then one day, you're not going to do any concerts ever again. No more Shea Stadium. No more playing out for the Queen. And the next time that you will see the Beatles is on a rooftop. And it's broken up like a bunch of teenagers where the cops actually go up and bust it up. Now, think about that.
Yeah, it is. It really defies belief that after 9/11, 1966, which appears to be the day that Paul died in what I take to have been an automobile accident, that the next month, Brian Epstein, their manager, announces they're no longer going to tour, when in fact the greatest rush of adrenaline for a rock band is to have this mass of adoring fans screaming and yelling, you know, for them. I mean, Gary, it's inconceivable that they would simply decide to no longer tour unless something extraordinary was going on, such that they were worried that the fans would discern that this was not the same person they've raved about before.
Look, as a musician, it's what you live for, and it's people can't get enough of that. I mean, what do you think about Chaka Khan? She was weighing like 400 pounds. She's not giving it up. There's people that go to their grave that will just never give this up because they want it so much. And then suddenly, no more shows. And then let's talk about the concerts and the money made by the concerts alone and the products being sold. And then suddenly we just stop it because, what was it the reason? That it was too dangerous?
Oh, the claim was they couldn't hear their own music.
Oh, okay, I got you. Man,
it
you know, we're just...
But they couldn't hear their own music as though they were there to play to hear their own music.
Yeah, like they could hear it before.
I know, it's absurd. It's absurd, Gary. Now listen, when we look at these portals and so forth, it's like comparing the teeth of Paul and Paul. We're comparing the portals of the Olympic and the Titanic, and they are not the same.
Right. Let's click a couple of pictures. Let's go to the next one. No. It was right next to the one that we had. It's right next to it. Yeah, I think it's that one. All right. Now you see how
we know now just because of those portholes that's Olympic. We know that's Olympic, whether it's called Titanic or not.
Right, but we're looking at windows now. You see the windows are irregular?
Can you give a chance the number of the slide you want, Gary?
That's the right one. That's the right one.
The one we got now?
Right. Now, okay. Let's take a look on C-deck. Not the top deck, the third deck. You can see that the windows are irregular. You see how, as you go across... Starting at the first funnel, pretty much?
Yeah. Well, by the second funnel, it's like there's a break there.
Right. There is a break there, and then there's a couple of them that are together and close by. All right. So let's toggle back up to the one above. Right. So
those are all totally uniform.
Right. Now, they do have a little break in there.
There's a little break, but they look very, very different.
Mm-hmm. Might have to click back and forth to check that out.
Yeah, this is not quite from the same angle, of course, but maybe you have other photographs here where we can see.
Yes, yeah, we can keep an eye.
Now, is this Olympic?
That's the Titanic.
That's Titanic. But Gary, really, we got to be real careful here because the ship they called Titanic was actually Olympic as I see it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we got to talk about like Titanic when it was in the shipyard. Versus Olympic when it was in the shipyard, or be very, very careful in how we talk about this so we don't confound the evidence.
Can I call it fall?
Yeah, you can call it fall.
All right. Okay, well, there's the evidence before us, the windows.
They look very different on this one, and this is Olympic.
Right.
Okay, so you're saying Titanic had better windows.
Well, they were just evenly spaced, and the Olympic ones were different. But let's click down to 19, see what it looks like there.
That was a little tough to make out because it's from so far back.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so if we go to...
Try 20, maybe.
Yeah, we can click around.
That's not very good either. 21, maybe?
Now, this is the last time that the two ships were seen together, ever.
Aha, very, very interesting.
All right, so this is the one, if we can see anything, this would be the one. Now, these are just screenshots, so I know there's better pictures for us to deal with.
Oh, Gary, there have to be whole photo albums of Titanic and Olympic. White Star.
I've got more books. I've got the plans. I've read all the books on all this stuff. So look, there's a lot of evidence that's available to us. But you know, like I said, we only planned on doing the show last night, and you know, we're doing the best we can at the moment. Now, if you click down to number 23,
yeah, that's
right. Now, part of the claim, right now. it is claimed that the Titanic and the Olympic had that black and white checkered tile. However, Bruce Ismay at the last moment decided he wanted it all covered in carpet. So
really? Really?
So part of the theory is that it was carpeted so it would look new. And that's one of the things is that, look, I've worked on ships. And look, after a year in service and all that, it's difficult to make anything look new again.
Had Olympic been in service for a year?
Yes, for 1 year.
Very, very interesting.
And it was the same crew that was that was familiar with Olympic. And so, look, you know, there's a smudge on your door handle or that little knock. You know, so it would be, just an unbelievable thing on a ship that has been in service for a year. And there are many, many witnesses that one of their first impressions, in fact, Ruth Baker, who was 7 years old, said the only thing she remembers on the ship, though she remembers vividly when she was in the lifeboat, was that everything was new. Just everything was new. Never, the sheets, brand new. You know, that all the sheets were new. The
of course, that's easy to do, to get new sheets.
Yeah.
Getting a new floor when it might have been scuffed by a year of service, that's a whole different matter.
Right. Well, the next picture is the carpeting, if you want to check that one out.
I do.
There you go. So we've got some carpeting going on here.
Can we compare the ceilings, the design of the ceiling if we go back? We can't quite see the ceiling, can we?
Yeah, you have to orient yourself sometimes. We may be looking at the same room. Let's look at the windows. Looks like the same type window there.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's much, much more to look into. Now, there was supposedly a plan B on slide 28. I mean, 26. I'm sorry, 26. Yeah. So this is a reenactment of one of the coal bunkers were supposedly on fire the whole time, and they had purposely set the fire. And if it necessary, they would just tell everyone on board that there was a fire and they had to get off the ship and then let it sink from there.
Oh, if it hadn't hit an iceberg, they were going to create a cause for the ship to go down.
Well, this is supposedly plan B here.
Okay.
And then the next, next photo, 27. Now, this is the ship that they were banking everything on and actually didn't come through for them.
It was a California? California?
Yeah, this is the Californian, and this is the one that they were planning on coming rescue everyone with no problems. And, it come to find out it didn't come anywhere close to that.
Well, it had to do with the signal, you know, the alarm that was fired up with the flares and all that, and the California not recognizing it or having been in radio silence when they set out the distress calls. It's really interesting how it got mucked up.
Well, the story that I've always heard is that the Titanic, it was a new thing, sending Morse code, and people were sending letters because they wanted to show off. And the Titanic was swamped with letters to send to people in New York. And he was actually transmitting to everyone through Morse code and was interrupted by the Californian with ice warnings. And he told him to shut up. I'm busy now. Leave me alone. And so after that, the guy said, well, to hell with them. I'm just going to go ahead and take my headset off. So once he put the headset down, there was no more electronic communications. However, there were people on the boat that saw the flares, but they thought it was a party going on and everything was fine. There's testimony about that. But this is the ship that ruined everything as far as Captain Smith. He lost his life. He's supposed to be in on it. Bruce Ismay, disgrace forever. Just a lot of stuff really didn't go right for a slick insurance plan. And from what I understand, the Titanic was underinsured by $2 million. I've got a document right here on that. So what I'd like to do is go through a couple of,
why don't you go through all your slides, Gary? Just go back from the beginning and go through them.
Okay. Well, we only have two left, I think. All right. So there's 28. That's just the crew. I think, Murdoch is the one on the left, if I'm not mistaken. We've got Captain Smith, got Light Toller. I'm not sure who's who. So that's the crew that was aboard. That was the Olympic crew, and they were supposedly chosen by Captain Smith to come over so they could keep a secret about all this. However, almost all of them drowned. So part of the documentary is saying that EJ was forced into doing this, and he wanted his men that he could trust to be on board. And then the last photo there, if
that was a hearing of the inquest, yeah, about it.
Inquiry, right, which was a whitewash from one end to the other. First of all, the company men would never admit that the ship broke in half. Besides, never mind all the people in the lifeboat said they saw it. And then finally, as in 1985, when Robert Ballard went down there, they did discover that the ship was broken in two pieces. See? Okay, so
they didn't want to admit it because it would have implied that the workmanship that went into the ship wasn't as sturdy and excellent that they as right. they claimed.
Right. It would have just been another blotch on the unsinkable ship that was.
Well, you know the architect admitted that he hadn't created these bulkheads that were all the way to the top, so that once one was broken and started to fill up, it would reach a point where it would start to fill up the next, and then the next, and then the next. That's how he was able to estimate how long it would take before the ship would sink.
Yeah, just like an ice tray, ice cube tray, the exact right. same principle. And as far as the inquiries, they just went, they followed the company line, you know, completely all the way. And Bruce Ismay, he actually locked himself in the quarters of the Californian and never came out. And he thought he was going to even try to catch a liner mid-ocean and hightail it back to Ireland.
Did he think maybe the passengers who remained were going to lynch him?
It was possible. It was possible. They had an awful lot of widows there. We're talking about not one street in Belfast did not have a widow, at least one. Every street had lost the breadwinner, and they had to take care of all them. They by no means got away scot-free whatsoever.
Gary, let's go back to the top of your slide set and go through them all to make sure we haven't missed anything.
Okay. We'll buzz through them. All right, there's White Star Line, Royal United Mail Steamer. That's what they were doing.
Take your time. Now, is that a photograph of Olympic or Titanic?
I would imagine it's the Olympic because the Titanic didn't last long enough for that. But
it was the first, so they would have had it available for photographs and other purposes longer.
Right. That looks like a drawing anyway. But the Olympic
it does say Royal and United States Mail Steamers.
Right. RMS.
Which is the RMS, as I explained in the introduction.
Uh huh.
The largest vessels in the world.
Right. They were going for comfort as far as the Cunard line. They were going for speed, but they decided not to do that. But another reason we know is that it says 45,000 tons. That was the gross tonnage of the Olympic. However, the Titanic exceeded that, you know, so it would be the largest vessel afloat and could be touted that way.
Right. That was what I was reporting, that discrepancy. Mm-hmm. The Titanic was supposed to have weighed in at 52,310 tons, 52,310 rather than merely 45,000.
Uh-huh.
Okay, go to the next. Let's just go through each member of your set to make sure we haven't missed anything. Okay.
All right, now we're talking over 15,000 to 16,000 workers, and they were used to working hard, and I just find it that there is a picture, which I didn't get in here, but the Olympic is leaving port, and it's going to New York. So I just don't understand that it's damaged so heavily. And part of the thing is there is that the vessel is repaired, but it's leaving port to go on a 2,000-mile voyage.
Gary, I thought that the tugboat that damaged the propeller, that actually happened in New York.
Right, but they repaired it, and it was back in service. I'm just saying that there's a lot of money to be made here, and not repairing the vessel. And it didn't, to me, when we get to the damage, it didn't look like it was to such
that serious. It didn't look that serious.
Had to pull off something like this.
And yet you can have an automobile with a bent frame, and it's not obvious to the naked eye either.
I just believe that there's things that you can do to the keel. I mean, they said the keel was bent. Now, after the Titanic sank, do you know that they had to go in and put a second bottom on each one of these ships? A second bottom. Now, how much work was that?
A second bottom on Olympic and on Titanic?
That's right. They went in and put a second bottom on each one of them. So that was just from the Board of Trade regulations. Now, let me say this real quick. One thing I do believe about this Titanic is that it was, regardless of how it happened, such a catastrophe that this is when they found out just how much power and control and new laws that you could pass and new organizations and new agencies because of this disaster. Now, what they figured out is that they don't have to wait for a real disaster of the Titanic proportions. They can just make it up.
It's very interesting, Gary, but you could be right that this was one of the first incidents of scamming the public. Although, you know, we had the explosion of the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor, which was a cause for the Spanish-American War, and it was never, ever shown that the Spaniards, the Cubans, had anything to do with it whatsoever. A boiler blew up.
Yeah, it was a coal fire again.
On the Maine. On the USS Maine, it is just not at all obvious that there was any, conspiracy involved there. Chance, by the way, has a question. Go right ahead, Chance.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if in either one of your research or when you guys were looking at this before or in the film that you're presenting after this in the hour-long film, did anyone mention the fact that the J.P. Morgan people We're trying to get the Federal Reserve into, like, you know, basically come about, and a lot of the opaments of the Federal Reserve were on the ship. And it went down, and they, you know, there's like 10 J.P. Morgan officials who didn't get on the ship, but the richest man in the world at the time got on the ship, and all the people who were against the Federal Reserve.
John Jacob Astor was on the ship, Benjamin Guggenheim, wealthy people, the Macy's people were there. Now that's another conspiracy. So there's more than one conspiracy. There's the one of the insurance fraud, and there's the one for the Federal Reserve.
Well,
so
it's
there's
like,
more than
it's
one.
Like,
so we'll have to.
It seems like 9/11, where you have the conspiracy where Larry Silverstein gets all the insurance money. So that's kind of like the insurance fraud of the boat. But then you've got the big conspiracy of like screwing the American people, starting all these illegal wars and all that crazy stuff that happened.
It was also an enormous theft of gold at the same time, you know. I mean, underneath the Twin Towers, there was a huge repository of gold that was stolen in the meanwhile, before the buildings were destroyed.
Yeah, and it seems like on the Titanic, the major conspiracy would be the, you know, creating the Federal Reserve and, you know, looting all money.
Well, it would probably turn out to be. I don't know. Would they have anticipated in advance how enormous that would turn out to be? I mean,
well, it seems to be the Rothschilds' quotes that you always hear famous is, you know, you don't care about, you know, who's running the country necessarily. You care about who controls their money.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Famous.
And all the different presidents that were against the central banks and how many times they just tried to create one and it just, let's kill everybody on a ship. That's pretty convenient sometimes.
Now, that I can see them doing to get the Federal Reserve in place. I can see that as a motive, but just to collect some insurance when it's estimated it was $125,000 to repair the boat. And look, these men, they've taken on whatever it takes. It's not the first time that they've rammed a boat and done repairs and things like that.
Let's just go through the rest of the slides to make sure we didn't miss anything.
Okay. Now, if we have time, I have a little list of questions I'd like to go through. We don't really have to answer them.
Okay. Just flip through the slides here so we make sure.
J.P. Morgan.
Because we didn't do them in order. So, yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. There's Lord Perry of the, Holland and Wolf Shipyard, the biggest shipyard in the world at the time. And that's Bruce Ismay, who jumped into a lifeboat and was shamed for the rest of his life.
Right.
There's Captain Smith right there on his final voyage on the RMS Titanic, ready to retire.
Keep going.
Okay. There's the damage that is supposedly significant.
The Hawk, HMS Hawk.
Right, to sink the whole ship and not put enough lifeboats for everybody on the boat, just in case the rickety California doesn't make it there. So, all right. Now, that's the actual repair, replacing the entire propeller off right. the Titanic. So it doesn't look like they're planning on not fixing it to me. All right. So now that's the blade that was replaced, I think, because of the tugboat, which was the first collision.
Right. Continue.
Okay.
This is the blade, actually.
Yeah. That's the whole propeller.
Okay.
All right, next.
Skip to, yeah.
Yeah. All right, I just took this side of the ship just in case you run across something else.
That's Titanic because it, look at those number of holes there. So that's right. Titanic, and the windows, which you pointed out before, Gary. That's good. You see the cabin windows.
That's right.
That's Titanic. Go mm-hmm. ahead.
All right, now, right here
is Olympic.
That's right. And it's got 16 portholes.
We got it. Titanic. Keep going.
With only 14.
Got it. Keep going.
And
that's Olympic.
Get, well, this no, that's is the Titanic.
Olympic. No, this is Olympic redesignated as Titanic, Gary.
Okay. All right. And then this is the two sister ships next to each other.
Yep.
Nothing really that I can see there. All right, here's the best that I could get as far as the windows
That's Titanic.
Right, uniform windows.
Keep going. That's Olympic, even if it's designated already as Titanic.
All right.
Keep going.
Now,
from the distance.
This is when they're parked one into the other. It takes two pictures to see it, but that's Titanic, and then the next picture is Olympic. But you can see that both are in the picture, but I wasn't able to get it all. So I didn't know if they were clear enough. Now, this is the one that we're going to have to really – get some close-ups because this is the last time, and this is the chance. This is where the switch would have had to occur at this time while they were sitting right next to each other.
Yeah, keep going.
All right, and that's just,
They're staining Olympic 45,000 tons and Titanic 45,000 tons, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We got a picture that's they say it's Olympic, but
right.
I'm looking. I'm trying to see if I can see the number of those little portals. It's not clear to me which it is. Then, of course, we got the class. We got the dining room. That's Titanic in the picture.
Okay.
With the even number of portholes. Good chance. Keep going. Go ahead.
Both had tile, and then 1 week before, Bruce Ismay supposedly had it changed to carpet. All right, then we've got plan B. Is the coal burning in the ship where they could just tell everyone to get off and then blow the ship up?
Okay, then, California.
Yeah. All right, so do we have a minute or two?
Yeah, go ahead, Gary. Lay them out.
All right. Now here's
go back to the where they're side by side chance. Go back to where they're side by side. That's our most interesting photograph. Yeah, yeah. Just leave it up there while Gary and I talk. Go ahead, Gary.
All right. These are 20 things that we have to consider as far as weighing the evidence on the switch happening or not. Number one, that the Titanic was underinsured by $2.5 million. There is documentation for that. And now the Olympics damage from the HMS Hawk did not exceed $125,000, which I said that was two cabins on one cruise.
Okay.
All right. Now next, 1 second. Wait, just 1 second. All right. Now the loss of the image of the White Star Line was more costly than repairing the vessel.
Yeah.
And also the money that is coming. It was pretty much the end for White Star Line. They went into service in World War One, and one of them was sunk. The Britannia was actually sunk in the war, World War One. So
it turns out that the Titanic, under the name of Olympic, ran a whole lot of trips, voyages on behalf of the British government in World War Two plus. So there was a whole lot going on with that ship. It was very, very active thereafter. Continue,
right.
Gary. Give us the rest of your questions.
Okay. The next question is it possible that several thousand Belfast workers would have to be silenced because they would have taken an awful lot of work to do this, and they would have had to be quiet. It wasn't just two people here. All right. Now, some of the Titanic passengers.
A lot of workers would just keep their mouths shut, Gary. They'd know better than to talk about it. It would be above their pay grade. Just
right.
Keep going, because we only have a couple minutes.
Okay. All right. Many of the passengers had sailed on the Olympic. It wouldn't have been their first time, and they would have noticed, some people say, all right, deliberately sinking the ship seems highly improbable and possible of it not succeeding.
Gary, it's either the same ship or it's different. I don't think there's actually any doubt about it. Give me the rest of your questions.
All right. No one reported that they noticed anything different after the Atlantic Olympic had sunk.
After the Titanic had sunk.
Right.
Go on.
There's also numbers of at the bottom of the ocean with the letters of Titanic where you can actually read it on the bottom.
But I won't throw the punchline. Gary, I won't throw the punchline of the documentary. Just give me the rest of your questions.
All right. I guess that's pretty much all the evidence that I have. And risky.
Gary, they were in a desperate situation. They took the action. Everyone watching should consider this to be our amateur diagnosis of the situation. What you're about to see is a very professionally produced and, in my judgment, expert analysis of what happened to Titanic and why. I want to thank Gary King for coming on with me for this first segment. Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, inviting you to stand by to watch the rest of the story.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies. But it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the Empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Less than 3% of you people read books. because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off, pal. Turn them off and leave them off.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Everyone knows the story of the Titanic, how the largest moving object ever fashioned by the hand of man hit an iceberg on its maiden voyage and sank in the middle of the North Atlantic. 1,500 lives were lost. The tragedy has been well documented in books and on film. No matter how often the story is told, it never fails to capture our imagination. Yet, it is a story that has left many questions unanswered. Now, for the first time, we take a fresh look at some of the mysteries surrounding the Titanic and reveal evidence that leads to a compelling and shocking hypothesis that the ship that plummeted 2 miles to the bottom of the sea was not the Titanic, but its sister ship, the Olympic. Built for the White Star Line by Belfast shipbuilders Harland and Wolff, whose chairman was Lord Pirrie. Harland and Wolff built ships almost exclusively for the White Star Line, which was acquired in 1903 by American financier J. Pierpont Morgan's International Mercantile Marine. This was part of a drive to create a monopoly on the lucrative North Atlantic passenger trade. Chairman of the White Star Line was J. Bruce Ismay. It was in fact Lord Pirrie who was responsible for bringing together Morgan's money and British engineering excellence. Over dinner at Pirrie's London residence in 1907, Lord Pirrie and White Star Line's Bruce Ismay conceived the idea of building 3 luxurious superliners. First the Olympic, then the Titanic, and finally the Britannic. The first of the new ships, Olympic and Titanic, were to be virtually identical. This represented the White Star Line's survival strategy in the highly competitive North Atlantic passenger market, while also ensuring a bright future for the Harland & Wolff shipyard. As well as holding a large financial stake in Harland & Wolff, Lord Pirrie was a shareholder in the White Star Line and the International Mercantile Marine. Almost all passenger liners on the North Atlantic route in the early part of the 20th century were immigrant ships. In poor condition, many were known as coffin ships, and their owners blatantly overloaded and overinsured their vessels. In fact, it was an industry noted at the time for fraud. On the 14th of June, 1911, the Olympic made her maiden voyage under the command of Captain Edward J. Smith, Commodore of the White Star Line. Then just a week later, still under the command of Edward Smith, the Olympic was involved in a stern collision with the tug O.L. Hallenbeck in New York, an accident that nearly caused the tug to sink. Barely 3 months later, on the 20th of September 1911, the Olympic, still under the command of Captain Smith, was involved in yet another collision, this time with the British warship HMS Hawk in the Brambles Channel in Southampton Water. It was a serious collision, which was to seal the fate of the Olympic. Pulled in by the suction from the Olympic's great propellers, the Hawk is irresistibly drawn towards the larger vessel, and the two ships collide. The Hawk's underwater ram and bows strike and penetrate the starboard side of the Olympic, causing a triangular hole several meters high, and an even larger hole below the waterline. Any accident involving a Royal Naval ship was investigated by the Admiralty, who, not surprisingly in this case, found that the Olympic was at fault, even though the evidence, including eyewitness accounts, suggested otherwise. As a consequence of this ruling, the White Star's insurers declined to pay out on the claim. The damage done to the Olympic was severe. Besides being hulled both above and below the waterline, she sustained numerous other injuries, including steel frames buckled, thousands of rivets popped, steel plating dislodged over 4 decks, and distortion to the starboard propeller and crankshaft. To make matters worse, the keel was bent, giving the ship a pronounced list to port. Interestingly enough, when 6 months later the ship which came to be known as the Titanic made her maiden voyage out of Southampton, second-class passenger Lawrence Beasley
a science teacher, noted that the ship seemed to have a slight but permanent list to port on the first part of the voyage, a fact noted by several other surviving passengers. The great hull was patched up in Southampton by riveting steel plates below the waterline and reinforcing with wooden beams above. This work took over 2 weeks, suggesting just how serious the damage was. In October 1911, with these temporary repair works in place, the Olympic then limped back to the Harland and Wolff shipyard in Belfast for more permanent repairs to be done. In fact, some of those temporary repairs failed during the voyage to Belfast. By the way, remember that although this is a model of the Olympic, the two ships were virtually identical. It's this fact which made a conspiracy feasible, a conspiracy of monumental proportions.
The starboard propeller is going to have to be replaced, and the crankshaft is damaged. There's a crack between the arm and the shaft. But worse, the keel is bent. That's going to give her a permanent list to port, and there's no way we can correct that. You're going to have to cut the ship in half, insert a new frame, and then put it all back together again. The job is going to take months, and frankly, for what it's going to cost, I think it's simply a waste of time.
Can you not just patch her up until Titanic is ready?
Well, we could put in a bulkhead to strengthen her. But to be honest, sir, she will never pass another Board of Trade inspection.
In Belfast, the Titanic was nearing completion, but all work on her stopped so that every effort could be put into the repair of the Olympic. This work took 7 weeks instead of the 2 weeks originally planned and involved replacing steel plates along fully one-third of the starboard side of the ship. Another indication that the damage was far worse than was originally thought. Now look at this. This is a film of the Olympic backing out of the dock in New York. You can see where she's been patched up on her starboard side. It's a huge area. And that's just the damage above the waterline. In order to get the Olympic back to sea and earning a profit as soon as possible, the starboard propeller, stamped with the Titanic's number 401 and not yet fitted to the Titanic, was fitted to the Olympic. This is a fact of some considerable significance, as we shall find out later. The Olympic's troubles, however, were only just beginning. After leaving New York Harbour on the 24th of February 1912, she ran over a sunken wreck off the Grand Banks and threw a propeller blade again on this starboard side. The loss of the propeller blade shock-loaded the engine and drive shaft and placed enormous stresses on the already weakened liner. She limped back to Southampton on only one engine, arriving there on the 28th of February. By the 2nd of March, she was once again in the Thompson Dry Dock in Belfast, having her propeller blade replaced. This should have taken only a few hours, but the Olympic was there, in Belfast, until the 7th of March. In Belfast, the Titanic and the Olympic were most often berthed side by side, and were regularly moved in and out of the Thompson Dry Dock, especially during repairs to the Olympic. On close examination of contemporary archive photographs, it is possible to see the minor differences in design that tell the two ships apart. On the forward part of C deck, Olympic was built with 16 portholes. The Titanic with 14. Somewhat mysteriously, the Titanic has acquired 2 extra portholes between its launch and its maiden voyage. This clearly points to the possibility that the two ships were switched. At the time of Titanic's launch, the windows on B deck are clearly discernible as being evenly spaced. Yet at the time of her maiden voyage, they have taken on a distinctly uneven appearance. And whereas the Olympic had been open to the public for inspection in Belfast and Liverpool, Titanic was not. That first week in March 1912 was the last time that the Olympic and Titanic were together in Belfast. The twin ships side by side on the River Lagan. And that was when the decision to switch them could have been made.
You can't be serious.
Olympic and Titanic are exactly the same. No one will know we've switched them when they get back to work on Monday morning. They'll just swap the names. Everything else is standard White Star issue. I have some boys at the yard who'll do the job for a couple of £100 each. Say nothing. We'll never get away with it. If word of this gets out... It's either that, Ismay, or we both go down. White Star Line and this yard. There's got to be another way. There isn't. We have no choice. Right. That's it then.
Switching the two ships would have been a remarkably simple undertaking. There were no members of the press poking around or roving TV crews looking for a story. Even photography was in its infancy at the time. And generally, people believed what they were told to be the truth. All crockery, linen and so on was White Star standard issue, interchangeable from ship to ship. Letterheads and menus, etc., were styled to the particular ship, but could easily have been changed. Only the names on the bows and sterns of the ships, the nameplates on the lifeboats and 48 lifebelts would have to be swapped. This could easily have been achieved using a very small crew, literally over a weekend. And it's highly unlikely that anyone would have noticed a switch when they returned to work on Monday morning. White Star often used photographs, both exterior and interior, of the Olympic as the Titanic, in their advertisements and press releases. Both ships had tiled and linoleum flooring. Yet, just days before Titanic's maiden voyage, Ismay, chairman of the White Star line, ordered her floors to be carpeted. Was this to cover Olympic's worn linoleum floors? The Harland and Wolff Yard was a vast labyrinth of buildings and workshops, as well as machinery and ships in various stages of completion. Any unusual activity would hardly be noticed. The social order of the day was such that the majority of the workers would never have thought to question their betters. They lived in a time when the majority of the population were told what to think, where to go, what to do and when to do it. It was also a lot easier in the early years of the century to bribe or even bully men into towing the company line, as we shall see when the surviving crew members return to Britain. There was no social security safety net for the unemployed, and companies had the power to dismiss whole families of workers if one of them did not do as he was told.
There's a wee scam going on here, and the bosses are in on it. They switched those ships 2 weeks ago, and I know it.
Listen to me, Paddy. Any more talk from you about two ships being swapped over, and you'll end up at the bottom of the River Lagan. So remember that when you get back to your wife and your 17 kids. You Irish scum.
The Olympic's original sea trials, conducted by the Board of Trade, lasted 2 full days, while the ship was put through its paces. Strangely, the Titanic's sea trials were a most peremptory affair. No strenuous manoeuvres were carried out, and the inspection was over in time for lunch. Of course, by now, the switch had taken place. The collision between the Olympic and HMS Hawke was by no means Captain Smith's first incident at sea. In fact, he had one of the worst professional records of his day. The Commodore of the White Star Line was a show-off, who liked to drive his ships as though they were giant speedboats, and he damaged a few in his time. The three incidents involving the Olympic, which probably damaged her permanently, must have put him in a very serious position in the eyes of his employers. Could he perhaps have been summoned by J. Bruce Ismay, chairman of the White Star Line, once it became obvious that the Olympic was a write-off? If so, it would have been a meeting with the very gravest of consequences.
Oh, come now, E.J.
We've always been good to you. Kept you in brandy and cigars. Besides, it's not going to be that difficult. You've broken a few of our ships, EJ. The Republic, the Germanic, the Coptic. And when that fire broke out on the Majestic and those crewmen were killed...
Yes, but...
Yes, I know you denied it had ever happened. But we did know. We gave you command of the Olympic, and look what a disaster that's turned out to be. And we always paid you well, EJ. Look, it's not for me. It's for the company. We are in a desperate situation financially, especially after what happened to the Olympic. So, I'm sorry to have to put it to you like this, but you do owe us. We've arranged for a small steamer from the Leyland line to be in a position to take the passengers off. I have a good man lined up for the job. Lord. Captain Stanley Lord. Ever come across him? Well, he's done this sort of thing before. Well, he did the job so well, he received a commendation for it. So, there it is. He'll be there to lend a hand. And I'll be there, of course. Along for the ride.
All right, then I want to choose my own officers.
Yes. Of course, EJ. Men you can trust, eh?
At the time of Titanic's maiden voyage, Britain was in the grip of a coal strike. Fuel was in short supply, and ships and men were laid up in Southampton. And yet, White Star Line had difficulty finding firemen and greasers to work below decks on the Titanic. After steaming from Belfast to Southampton, all but two of the firemen aboard the ill-fated liner refused to sign up again in Southampton for the voyage across the Atlantic, preferring to wait for employment on another ship. All these men, in the middle of a coal strike, with so many thousands laid off, what did they know? Shortly before Titanic sailed, Chief Officer Wilde, who was to lose his life 3 nights later, wrote a letter to his sister, in which he said, "I still don't like this ship." Strange thing for a man to say, who had just set foot on board the day before. Unless, of course, he realized he was actually on his old ship Olympic. It's strange to think that as the Olympic, now renamed the Titanic, was preparing to make her second maiden voyage, the ship that started out life as the Titanic and was now called the Olympic had to enter her working life with no fanfare at all. The Olympic's original maiden voyage was fully subscribed, whereas her second, this time as the Titanic, was only about half full, and that in the middle of a coal strike when passengers were queuing up to get to America. First-class passengers on other White Star ships were only offered second-class berths on Titanic, even though we know that first-class cabins were available. It's almost as though White Star Line didn't want that many people on board. By the way, when I refer to the Titanic from this time on, I want you to remember that I'm actually talking about the ship that started out its life as the Olympic, but which we believe by this stage had been switched and taken on the identity of the Titanic. The coal strike is important for another, possibly more sinister reason. Most other ships were desperate for coal, and passengers and cargo destined for the New World were stuck in Europe. Yet, the Leyland liner Californian, under the command of Captain Stanley Lord, left the port of London on the 5th of April, 1912, just 5 days before Titanic's departure from Southampton, not only fully coaled, but apart from her own crew, empty of passengers. With more than enough coal to get her to the United States, she headed off into the middle of the Atlantic at full speed, empty. Apart from a cargo of woolen sweaters. Over 50, mostly first-class passengers, cancelled their passages on the Titanic at the last minute, many of them close friends and business associates of J.P. Morgan. Morgan himself cancelled his passage at the 11th hour, despite having the best suite on the ship, claiming illness. 2 days after the sinking, an American reporter found him in perfect health at the French resort of Aix-les-Bains, with his mistress. Morgan also had several valuable bronze statues, which he was planning to import to the United States, taken off the Titanic an hour before she sailed. Could Morgan have known the fate of the Titanic fully 4 days before the disaster? Florence Ismay, wife of J. Bruce Ismay, also turned down the opportunity of taking the maiden voyage on the world's most luxurious liner, preferring instead to take their children on a motoring holiday, after first claiming ill health. Now, there is one thing that sailors fear above all else, and that is fire at sea. And yet, when Titanic cast off from Southampton, there was a fire smouldering in number 10 coal bunker. Instead of putting out the fire, the bunker was actually topped up with 400 tons of coal. Captain Smith knew it, the ship's officers and chief engineer knew it, as did those who worked half-heartedly to put it out. The fire that had been smouldering in coal bunker number 10 had been smouldering for a week, and yet it was kept from the Board of Trade Inspector, Maurice Harvey Clark, who at the British Inquiry denied all knowledge of it. Could the fire in coal bunker number 10 have been Plan B? If all else fails, tell the passengers there's a fire, vent the smoke through the ship, and get them off that way. Captain Stanley Lord and the Californian had left the port of London in a great hurry, ostensibly bound for Boston. Then, on the evening of the 14th of April, the ship came to a dead stop in the middle of the ice field. Strangely, Captain Lord, 6 foot tall, elected to sleep that night fully clothed on a 5.5 foot couch in the chart room rather than in his cabin. He also ordered her boilers to be kept fired up and her engines on standby. Why? Was he expecting some sort of emergency that might mean a last-minute dash into the night? That evening, the Titanic received 6 radio messages. The first 3 were from other ships, giving the location of icebergs. The other 3 were from the Californian, more concerned with giving her own position stopped for the night. Those 3 were personally addressed to Captain Smith. It's almost as if Captain Lord was letting Smith know that the Californian was ready and waiting. Captain Smith had delayed turning the corner on the outward southern track. He ordered the turn to the west 10 miles further south than the normal turning point. This was certainly not as an evasive measure to avoid the ice field, but one designed to take him directly into it. He must have known this. Tragically, Captain Lord failed to keep his radio operator awake. Even so, the Californian's last message to the Titanic never got there. The Titanic's radio operators were too busy with passengers' messages. It was standard practice of the day for captains to run their ships at full speed through the ice field. Any object large enough to damage an iron steamship would be seen in plenty of time to avoid it. Other ships in the vicinity cruised on at full speed on that night, so in that respect, Captain Smith was by no means unique. So why, then, was the Californian stopped? Had she reached her destination and was she now waiting? Sometime before 11 p.m, lookouts Fred Fleet and Reginald Lee came on watch and climbed to the crow's nest. Captain Smith retired for the night, but coincidentally, like Stanley Lord, he also chose to rest fully clothed, not in his own cabin, but in the chart room behind the bridge, almost as if he expected to be called back to the bridge at any moment. It was very cold outside, and few, if any, passengers would have been on deck. First Officer Murdoch was standing on the open part of the starboard side of the bridge when he saw the iceberg about 800 yards ahead. He ordered the ship turned to port and, inexplicably, engines full astern. By reversing the engines, Murdoch was actually increasing the risk of collision, something he must have known. Maybe Murdoch, hand-picked by Captain Smith, was deciding to give the iceberg a nudge anyway. Given that the turning circle of the Titanic was 1,280 yards and the stopping distance 850 yards, Titanic should have been able to avoid the iceberg with the greatest of ease, even allowing for a slight delay while orders were given and the wheel turned the ship to port. So why didn't it? Second Officer Lightoller told the inquiry that before going off duty for the night, he would have been easily able to see an iceberg from a mile and a half, more probably 2 miles away. He also said that the iceberg would have been just as visible from the bridge as from the crow's nest. Plenty of time to turn and avoid it then. In an emergency such as this, it was never a good idea to turn your broadside to danger. Even if Titanic had rammed the iceberg head-on, it would have stayed afloat. Although up to 250 crewmen would have been killed while they slept in their bunks in the bow. Apart from those on the bridge, and of course those in the forward boiler rooms, the glancing blow with the iceberg would have passed virtually unnoticed. The vibration felt by some of the passengers was almost certainly that caused by the reversing of the engines, and by the time anyone noticed what had happened, the iceberg had slipped away into the night. Captain Smith was on the bridge in a matter of seconds, but instead of a general call to stations, his officers acted as though there were no emergency at all. Second Officer Lightoller, awakened by the sound of steam letting off, claims to have stayed in his cabin until another officer came to get him. His evidence later, to the effect that he had stayed there because he was off duty and thought he should stay where he would expect to be found, simply does not ring true. The bridge was only a few seconds' walk from his cabin in the officer's quarters, and he should have gone straight there at the first hint of trouble. So why didn't he? A few passengers came out of their cabins to see why the engines had stopped, but for the first 40 minutes after the collision, there was really no sense of danger at all. One can understand this frame of mind on the part of the passengers, even on the part of the crew. Except for those who were dousing the fires in boiler rooms 5 and 6. After all, they thought they were on an unsinkable ship. But for the captain and the officers, who were in full possession of the facts, there is really no excuse. They dithered because they expected to be rescued. It was 35 minutes before the first distress signal was sent. 35 minutes before the first radio emergency, CQD, was sent. 45 minutes before starting the pumps. 45 minutes before starting to prepare the lifeboats. And a full hour and 25 minutes before the first one was launched. Only 6 crew members were on watch at the time Titanic struck the iceberg. First Officer Murdoch and Sixth Officer Moody were later drowned. Of the surviving crew members, Quartermaster Alfred Oliver was aft of the bridge at the time and saw nothing. Helmsman Robert Hitchens was hastily transferred to a job as harbour master in Cape Town, which leaves lookouts Frederick Fleet and Reginald Lee. At the British inquiry, as a witness, Frederick Fleet was clearly defensive, edgy, obviously didn't trust his questioners, and at times was downright surly. But then he was under the watchful gaze of J. Bruce Ismay, the chairman of the White Star Line, and the lawyers.
I'm no judge of distances or spaces.
Was it a mile away, or how far away was it?
I cannot say.
Can you not give any estimate?
No.
Was it half a mile?
I cannot say. It is impossible to tell.
Was it as far away as the boat's length?
I could not say.
Can you not say anything about it?
No, sir.
You really do not understand. Gentleman is not trying to get round you at all.
Well, some of them are, though. Is there any more I'd like to have a go at me?
When Titanic came to a rest, Captain Smith asked the fourth officer, Joseph Groves Boxall, to work out a position. It is clear from the records that Titanic's navigator worked out a position that was 12 miles away from where they actually were. This was to prove a fatal mistake. We know he was 12 miles out in his calculations because of the actual location of the wreck. The position that Boxall gave would have put the Titanic within sight of the Californian. Was that where he thought he should have been? For some reason, Captain Smith ordered the Titanic to move half speed ahead for another 5 minutes before stopping the engines again for the last time. Maybe he was heading towards the ship whose lights could just be made out on the horizon, expecting it to be the Californian. Several survivors mentioned the sighting of a ship about 5 or 6 miles from the Titanic. The Titanic could easily have steamed there, yet Smith was content to assume the ship would sail over to him, because he believed it was the Californian. At this point, let's examine what's happened so far. A stricken ocean liner is dead in the water. A rescue ship, the Californian, is standing by. Messages have been sent to Captain Smith from the Californian, stating exactly where she is waiting. Captain Smith can see a stationary ship on the horizon, and having received inaccurate information from Fourth Officer Boxall as to his position, he assumes it's the Californian and everything's going according to plan. At about midnight, Titanic started sending up her distress rockets, red, white, and blue. Rockets could also be seen from the bridge of the Californian, and this was duly reported to Captain Lord. Captain Lord asked what colour the rockets were. In fact, over the next 2 hours, Lord repeatedly asked his officers about the colour of the rockets. Was he expecting to see red or blue signals? Very likely. But whether he was or not, the answer from the bridge was always the same. Only white rockets could be seen. He therefore, rightly, assumed that the rockets were not coming from the Titanic. Survivors reported that the rockets launched from the bridge of the Titanic soared up several hundred feet into the night sky, bursting with an ear-splitting report. The rockets from the ship that was visible from the Californian only went as high as the top of her mast, and even at 4 to 5 miles distant, the officers would have quite reasonably expected to hear a report, but they heard nothing. It seems most likely that the ship seen from the Californian was a wooden sailing bark called the Samson, conducting illegal seal fishing activities on the ice floes at the time. The white rockets she was firing, to mast height only, were intended to recall her small rowing boats. A few months after the disaster, the captain of the Samson said that he had also seen a large liner firing rockets and that he had not gone to investigate because of his own illegal activities. The Californian's apprentice, Gibson, later testified that he saw only 8 rockets fired from the ship and all white. The Titanic had fired at least 18, possibly as many as 22, and had included red and blue. Titanic survivor Miss Edith Russell said the officers told them all, "Don't worry, the Californian will pick everybody up if you don't come back for breakfast." How could they possibly have known it was the Californian? It's hard to believe in such an emergency, but they were letting lifeboats go half full. They knew the ship was sinking, nobody could be that stupid. But they expected the ship on the horizon to come steaming over. But it was the wrong ship. The Californian was 19 miles away, where Captain Stanley Lord waited for coloured rockets. At around 1 a.m., it must finally have dawned on Captain Smith that the rescue upon which the survival of so many depended was not going to materialize. Now boats are being let go full, and passengers are beginning to panic. As the senior surviving officer, much credence and publicity was given to the evidence of Second Officer Lightoller.
"I did not leave the Titanic, sir. The Titanic left me."
He was evasive in response to pertinent questions at the American and British inquiries, out to protect first and foremost his own reputation and then that of the White Star Line. At the British inquiry, he claimed,
"The Titanic began her turn to port before the lookout rang down from the crow's nest."
How would he have known this? He said he was in his cabin at the time. Lightoller also said at the American inquiry,
"There was no mist 10 minutes before the ship struck the berg,"
flatly contradicting the evidence of the two lookouts. And how would he have known this if he was in his cabin? He also lied about the number of ice warnings received on the bridge, as if to suggest that the iceberg came as a surprise.
"I do not remember any ice warnings being posted on the bridge."
Lightoller, along with second radio operator Harold Bride and ship's baker Charles Joffin, all claimed that after getting off the Titanic, they stayed in the water for up to an hour.
"I was in the water for between half an hour and an hour before I climbed aboard the upturned collapsible. 20 of us spent most of the rest of that night balancing on the upturned boat, while I gave the orders, lean left and lean right."
This is quite clearly not possible. We know that the sea temperature that night was between 2 and 3 degrees below freezing. Average life expectancy at that temperature, between 3 and 4 minutes. This testimony would simply not stand up today. It is quite clearly fabrication. Just before 5:30 on that fateful morning, Captain Stanley Lord woke his radio operator, only to discover that the Titanic had already sunk. He set off at full steam for the wreck site, but of course he was too late. The Carpathia had already arrived and was picking up survivors. Notable amongst these was J. Bruce Ismay, who had slipped into a lifeboat at the last minute. For this he was to pay the price in public shame for the rest of his life. As the Carpathia steamed towards New York, Ismay was supposedly taken to the doctor's cabin and put under sedation. Even so, he managed to find time to send 3 separate telegrams to the White Star's New York office, urging them to hold the Cedric in New York Harbour so that the Titanic's surviving crew members could be taken straight back to Southampton. Hastily organised, the American inquiry failed to ask the right questions. Titanic surviving officers stonewalled, as did Ismay himself. Several experienced sea captains were called to give evidence regarding the wisdom of steaming at full speed through an ice field. But they all said the same thing. Maintaining full speed in the vicinity of ice was perfectly normal, and on the night in question, the icebergs could be seen at between 5 and 6 miles distant. It never occurred to anyone to ask the simple question, in that case, why did the Titanic hit an iceberg? When the surviving crew got back to England, they naturally expected to go straight home to their loved ones. Instead, they were all herded into a railway shed and held for nearly 24 hours before being made to sign pieces of paper. A lot of them were under the impression that they were signing the Official Secrets Act. Was someone trying to suppress something here, some vital piece of information?
Remember what it is you've put your names to. If there's any talk of the ship being swamped in Belfast, or any stories of insurance fraud going on, then there will be 20 years of His Majesty's pleasure awaiting you and no job to come out to when it's over. So, think on this when you see your wives and sweethearts.
Ismay, Lightoller and the other surviving officers all came back to England on the steamship Adriatic. There can be little doubt as to the main subject of conversation on their voyage. They were all to be star witnesses in the forthcoming British inquiry. Now, it is unlikely that a fraud of such immense proportions could have been undertaken without the collusion of the authorities, notably the British government, as we shall see later when we look at the inquiry. In fact, it makes perfect sense for the government of the day, under Prime Minister Lord Asquith, to have colluded in a cover-up.
You'll never believe what they've just done.
How many?
I'm told 1,500. The position is simply this, Prime Minister. The White Star Line is on the verge of bankruptcy. Now, if White Star were forced to go into liquidation, the Harland and Wolf Yard in Belfast would also be placed in a very precarious position, perhaps even forced to close down. Now, that means that 20,000 men will be laid off, not to mention the effect on all the subsidiary and dependent industries. Quite frankly, it is a political situation we cannot afford, Prime Minister. Alienate the Irish, and we will most certainly lose seats in Belfast. The Fenians, the Republicans, will seize the opportunity. And with our majority gone, we will undoubtedly lose the next election, Prime Minister.
There is the chance of a blunder here of unprecedented proportions.
We are going to have to go along with this, Prime Minister.
I will not see a stain put upon the British government.
Nor for the White Star Line, not for Holland and Wolfe, not for the Irish, and certainly not for the interests of J.P. Morgan.
I would also remind you, Prime Minister, that as part of the arrangement for an American company to acquire the White Star Line, J.P. Morgan agreed that this government could requisition his ships as Royal Naval Reserves should the need arise. I would also remind you, Prime Minister, that the situation in Europe is becoming ever more doubtful. If the White Star Line were to go into liquidation, the major creditor would be J.P. Morgan himself. Now, as both owner and banker, he would certainly exercise his rights to seize his assets. And we would lose all those ships, Prime Minister.
It's a sad day for England when the policies of a British government are dictated by greedy and ruthless businessmen. And if it ever became public... Doubtless you have someone in mind to run the show?
Yes. I thought we could bring Mersey out of retirement. He's reliable, he knows how the system works, he's discreet, and he will do what needs to be done.
My son is called to the bar. I would be more comfortable if he were there to keep an eye on things.
Of course, Prime Minister, we'll find employment for him in the Attorney General's office.
Very well, then. But neither I nor the administration know anything about it.
So, the Board of Trade inquiry was to be conducted by Lord Mersey, President of the Board of Trade and no stranger to the art of cover-up. Since the enormous loss of life was in part due to outdated Board of Trade regulations regarding the number of lifeboats to be carried by ships and the safety of ships at sea generally, it was hardly likely that the inquiry was going to be too concerned with uncovering the truth, the Board of Trade being both plaintiff and defendant in the case. The hearings were held at the Scottish Drill Hall in London, where the acoustics were so bad that spectators in the public galleries found it difficult to hear everything that was said. Lord Mersey had complained about the unfortunate choice of venue, but then again it had been booked by his son. Harold Sanderson, representing Harland and Wolff, repeatedly made the mistake of referring to the Titanic as the Olympic. As for Lord Mersey himself, he simply didn't ask or allow to be asked the right questions. The press, who were there throughout the hearings and could have done something about it, were more interested in the scandal surrounding the lucky escape of J. Bruce Ismay. Other expert naval officers told Lord Mersey that even on a moonless night there'd be no difficulty spotting an iceberg from as far away as 6 or even 10 miles. Remember, the full turning circle of the Titanic at top speed was only 3/4 of a mile. The whole British inquiry was a whitewash. Captain Smith would not be blamed because he was no longer alive and could not defend himself. The lookouts were not to blame. The design and construction of the Titanic was not to blame. Neither were her officers or her owners. In fact, no one was to blame. Except Captain Lord. Captain Lord stood alone. If Lord Mersey heard anything at the inquiry that he didn't like, he simply ignored it.
She looked like a small tramp steamer about 5 miles away. They were firing rockets just after midnight. Altogether, she fired 8 rockets, and all white, and rose no further than the masthead.
I think we are all of the opinion that the distress signals, which were seen from the deck of the Californian, were, in fact, the distress signals from the Titanic.
I went down below to Captain Lord, who was sleeping in the chart room. He asked me again if I was sure there was no colour in the rockets. So I said, no, they were all white.
I think the onus of proof in this matter is upon the Californian. That it will be for the Californian to satisfy us that they were not the signals of the Titanic.
Whenever a Titanic survivor referred to the mystery ship that they'd seen on the horizon, as often as not, Lord Mersey would interject with,
"You mean the Californian?"
There was barely an attempt at cross-examination, and, as happened so often, Captain Lord declined to defend himself. Perhaps out of fear that he might reveal his part in the conspiracy. Furthermore, when the inquiry heard from passengers who'd been aboard the Mount Temple that they'd actually seen the Titanic on the horizon, and were even close enough to hear the last two reports of her rockets, Lord Mersey repeatedly interrupted them.
You do not give me the answers that please me.
Of course, if Lord Mersey was a party to the cover-up, he would have known about Captain Lord's secret mission and of how the rescue plan failed, largely because of circumstances outside Captain Lord's control. And yet, Lord Mersey repeatedly interrupted the testimony of Californians' officers and instead accepted evidence against Captain Lord that would have been laughed out of court under normal circumstances. Was Captain Lord being made a scapegoat because he had failed to do what he'd been engaged to do on the night of the disaster? Of course, by highlighting Lord and the Californian, Lord Mersey was drawing attention away from rather more sensitive issues. Titanic's bulkheads should have gone one deck higher. It was the Board of Trade's own regulations that allowed Titanic to go to sea with too few lifeboats, and the Board of Trade's inspectors who had been so ready to sign the ship off as fit to go to sea in the first place. Titanic cost $10 million to build, and as a brand new ship, would have been insurable for that amount and more. The Olympic, on the other hand, damaged beyond economic repair, would only have been insurable for a much smaller amount. A motive for switching the ships is clear. Normally, White Star Line, when they insured their ships, took on part of the risk themselves, and it was at first thought that Lloyd's of London would only be liable for $7.5 million. Not so. For just 1 week before the maiden voyage of the Titanic, which we now know was in fact the Olympic, White Star Line upped their insurance on the vessel dramatically. And, incredibly, just 5 days after the sinking, Lloyd's paid out $12.5 million. Although three-quarters of a century at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean did not exactly preserve Titanic in museum-like condition, there is enough left of the wreck to give us more than just an idea of what really happened. Corrosion has done its relentless work, but where the original black paint of the hull has flaked away, it is still possible to see spots of grey paint, which formed the undercoat, except that grey paint was only used as an undercoat on the Olympic and not on the Titanic. Examination of the starboard propeller reveals the number 01 stamped into the metal. In fairness, there is too much corrosion to make out the number 4 clearly, but remember, the starboard propeller, numbered 401 for the Titanic, was put on the Olympic as part of the repairs after the collision with the Hawk. Remote cameras under the control of the discoverer of the Titanic wreck, Dr. Robert Ballard, have examined the stern section of the ship. They show that in addition to the lateral bulkheads that were a feature of both the Titanic and the Olympic, there is a longitudinal bulkhead in the stern section where there was none on the original plans for either vessel. The position of this bulkhead suggests a temporary repair has been carried out to strengthen the keel, a keel perhaps damaged by the collision with HMS Hawk. And finally, a close look at the bow could reveal the most damning evidence of all. In 1986, the French National Oceanographic Institute examined the wreck with Dr. Robert Ballard. One of the things they checked was the name of the ship. In keeping with White Star tradition, both ships had their names engraved into the upper bow plates in letters 4 foot high. Examination of the wreck and the name Titanic shows that it is made of iron letters which have been riveted onto the original bow plates. With the passage of time, two of the letters have dropped off and been lost forever in the sediment of the seabed. At the place where they once were, engraved into the hull, are the letters M and P.